Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 331st episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and as always, I'm a professor from the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia, but that is the only thing that's normal about this podcast, right, Mike?
Well, certainly neither of us are normal. I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta, but I am not presently at the University of Alberta. I am stuck here in James's luxurious BC studio.
For the first time, I think we believe, in 331 episodes.
We have been in the same room on a couple of them very early on.
Did we? And
yes, it was a rundown building in...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And once we got the rat trap set up, we were absolutely fine for the rest of the...
Yeah, that's right. I forgot we did... But this is really for many, many years, we've not actually done a podcast in the same room.
In fact, we try to spend as little time in the same room as possible.
Oh, we did test each other. I mean, who would want to be in the same room with either of us? So this is the unique thing about this podcast, and we're going to see how it goes, because it's just a slightly different format, and we couldn't really come up with a better topic than for us to both be in the same room together than to talk about
sexual function,
erectile dysfunction.
Yeah. I like to look at it as the other way, function versus dysfunction. I'm the glass is half full.
Oh.
Or half
whatever. There may be a pun or two.
There may be, as we weed through the soft evidence and get to the hard facts.
Yes.
It's just too easy.
It's too easy, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not going to stoop to that level.
Well, we will. So the plan is to talk about erectile dysfunction or function, if you will.
Yes.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the evaluation of it, if you will, and there is no reason why Mike had to be here for this. It just so happened that he was in Vancouver. And then we're going to talk about what the best available evidence is that we have. We'll compare and contrast the different treatments that are available and trying to put it all into context.
Now, the original title you sent me was ED, A Personal Journey.
Yes. Yes.
So, I don't know, do you want to go into your case example? Or
No. Well, because it really should be erectile function, a case example. This is not going well so far.
No.
So, let's talk a little bit about epidemiology. Would you like to do that?
I'd love to do that.
Yes.
Let's explore that topic.
So, we'll get into sort of the scale, and it doesn't matter what word we're going to use. Anything's going to sound funny when we talk about...
I know there's different tumescent scales and that kind of thing. And there's a word that you don't really see used very often, tumescent.
No.
In regular conversation.
And how do you spell that?
You know very well, I would have no idea. Yeah. I'm pretty sure there's a T.
Yes. And that's it.
Or a soft E.
Yes. I think it's a silent P as well. So when you look at, you know, the actual incidence of erectile dysfunction, it obviously, the major factor is age. Now, there's clearly disease states that can precipitate it.
For sure. And for anyone who's been in practice, they've seen many of those manifest. I've even, some of us who have been in practice long enough will have had patients who've had surgery for a variety of causes in the perineum, and they'll have lost, function due to that, due to nerve damage. There's a whole bunch of reasons, potentially. But the most common one is just slow age degeneration.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we've got some sort of epidemiology information in front of us, and if you look at age 40 to 44, and this is, I'm pretty sure it's primarily males they're talking about. if they do sort of the percentage of males age 40 to 44 who have no erectile dysfunction is around getting upwards of 80%, and then you have a sort of complete erectile dysfunction in about... what we say, sort of 5 to 10% at most,
yeah.
And then everyone sort of else is in between. But when you and there's a gradual decline, if you will, as you get older, and as you get to the age of, you know, between 75 and 80, no erectile dysfunction is around 10%, and people with complete erectile dysfunction is around 50%. So clearly, the epidemiology gets worse as you go along.
Yeah, and
now depending on whether worse is this means worse. Some people would not say it.
So when you're, particularly originally when we were seeing patients coming in and they knew, we'll talk about different interventions, but with the medications like sildenafil and that kind of thing, it actually, we have patients coming in because they knew there was a potential pill that was easier to take, etc., and it was perceived to have few side effects. And so we saw more people coming in, but sometimes they were coming in as couples as well.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because in those kind of scenarios, you have the conversation with both. And sometimes there certain members of the couple were more excited about getting access to that medication than others.
And by excited, you mean what?
Enthusiastic.
Enthusiastic, yes. So talking about being enthusiastic, I think... I think one of the things we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the studies that are associated with erectile function, and obviously you have to have a scale, right, Mike?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you can't use a ruler. Well, you could.
You could. You know what, before we journey down that, about the whole that every ruler has, anyway, you know what, we're going to stop right there and get back to the scale that you used to score tumescence.
Yes, that's what I was going to get to. So, there's a thing called the International Index of Erectile Function, or IIEF-5, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And
used regularly in clinical practice.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the scale is, they ask a few questions. They ask, over the past 6 months, how do you rate your confidence that you could get and keep an erection? And from all the way from very low to very high. And again, I'm sure there's a joke there. When you had erections with sexual stimulation, how often were your erections hard enough for penetration? During sexual intercourse, how often were you able to maintain your erection after you had penetrated your partner, etc.? During sexual intercourse, how difficult was it to maintain your erection, to complete intercourse? And when you attempted sexual intercourse, how often was it satisfactory to you? And you get a score of 1 to 5 in all of those things. And so there's 5 things. So if you score 25, absolutely no problem. And if you score 1, that would be
all
severe.
All across the board, yeah.
All across the board, yeah. I guess they actually have 0 in here when they put it all together. Because the scale is 1 to 7 is severe, and then 20 to 25 is none, and then all the everything else in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to get to that, but so that's how we actually sort of make an assessment of erectile function. But that's not, you don't do this in clinical practice.
No, of course you don't.
Yeah.
And that's true of many scales
that
you use in clinical practice. But in a research study, of course, they're very applicable because you need to have some kind of concrete example of where you are, for lack of a better word, something firm.
Yes.
That you can use to assess to see change. Actually.
Right, yeah,
and,
yeah. Yeah.
And then categorize into groups. And then you can use that even to say you've crossed a certain threshold now. From moderate to severe disability or what have you. And so that's why these scales are helpful, but not necessarily useful. They're
in clinical
helpful
practice.
In research, but not useful in clinical practice.
Yeah, and allows for consistency between
examples.
Yeah. So what's the typical way that you see this, and I'm going to very quickly add, in your practice?
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
Yes.
it's an interesting thing. So obviously, it's mostly men, but occasionally females will raise it with their husband in the room. And I can think of one occasion where it was just about the husband whose partner was trying to encourage him to come in and wanted to know, kind of what was involved. Anyhow, but most often it's brought up in a way of probably at least 50% is what. Do you prescribe Viagra or something along those lines? They don't ever say sildenafil. They might say Cialis or something. But they'll actually ask for the medicine or something about that. It's a very uncomfortable topic for everyone involved. And then the question...
Including you.
Yeah, that's exactly. Mostly me.
Yeah.
And then most of the questions are obviously quite uncomfortable too, because you're asking them, do you have difficulty, do you still get erections... when you wake up, do you still have morning erections? Do you when you're masturbating or by yourself, do you still have difficulty with erections? And those kind of questions are part of the history, and they're uncomfortable for everyone. So I often will caveat it, like, well, we need to ask you some questions to find out what could be the cause of this, and And I let them know that some of the questions may seem a little uncomfortable, but it's not meant to be that way. And they're quite helpful for us to
decide
what's needed for you.
Yeah. And some of the stuff, I mean, is really one of the key things is establishing the timing of it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a difference between gradual onset erectile dysfunction, which, you know, sort of suggests some sort of an organic cause, and by that just sort of potentially getting older.
Sure.
Versus if it's a sudden onset, that would shift you a completely different, either, you know, social or psychological type of cause. And so that's, you know, you need to sort of identify that sort of process.
For sure. And that the origin of how it started, if it's gradual or sudden, is a key thing. And you can, when they're the sudden ones, you can, it's not uncommon to be able to kind of nail down the exact or around that time, and some kind of serious event in the relationship occurred or something happened.
Yeah, and that the completely almost different management of that, right? You know,
Interestingly, sildenafil and the other products in that genre can help.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it'll help even if there's not even necessarily a problem. It will make it better or worse depending on which partner you're talking about or contextually.
For sure.
So we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about sort of the situational one, whether it be, you know, some sort of a specific event or depression or whatever, but you need to make sure it's not that, or at least sort of rule that out.
Yeah.
And I would imagine there's a couple of questions that you can ask, you know, if you're having, you know, erections with your partner, or better, like if you're having erections at sleep time, that tells you that you can actually have an erection.
Yeah, and anatomically things are working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of that's basically what you're trying to figure out. If anatomically things are working, then it's a completely different process.
But interestingly, as I mentioned, sildenafil can overcome, to a certain extent, both problems. It can't overcome severe anatomical problems, and it can overcome severe emotional, social things.
So, right. And then what you obviously want to rule out is you want to rule out anything that's sort of a reversible cause.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a list of that. I mean, there's low testosterone, and again, we're not going to get into that for this sort of thing, but there can be prostatitis, some sort of traumatic vascular damage. But one of the key things, you know, can obviously be medications.
Yeah. And interestingly, things that we don't think of necessarily, like people used to talk about beta blockers, but actually thiazides.
Yes.
Are an equivalent or worse.
Exactly.
So,
when you look at sort of the epidemiology of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know about you, when I'm trying to figure out if a drug is causing something in someone, it's really about timing. Like, you know, you just got to establish that timing. Yeah. So it could, you know, if all of a sudden they had no erectile dysfunction at all, and now they do, and you started a drug, and it almost wouldn't matter what drug it was, I would thinking it could possibly be that. But, you know, you're right, there's a bunch of ones that are quite common. Many of the antidepressants can cause erectile dysfunction.
Oh, yeah, they can cause a problem with almost every element
of sex. You can have anorgasmia, you know, all sorts of different things. And in fact, almost any of the psychotropic type drugs have been associated with
culprits.
That. Yeah. And then obviously cardiovascular drugs. Now it's a bit tricky, right? Because, and we're going to get into this when we talk about some of the potential causes. I mean, if you are on medication for cardiovascular disease, it may be because you have some sort of atherosclerotic process going on, which can lead to the erectile, you know, it's a vicious cycle.
And it's interesting. So even now here we are talking about medications, and let's say you've got someone who struggled to get, really suffered from depression, and this was years ago in my practice, and then finally found something and feels great in every way, but has difficulties with sexual function, and it was particularly ED. And back then we really didn't have sildenafil or anything, but research showed that, as you may well talk about, that even with erectile dysfunction associated with the pill, the best thing to always do is to stop that pill if you can. But if for some reason they really do need it, again,
I was going to say you're kind of screwed, but
yeah, subtle like a brick.
But see, if I would have said that in another podcast, it wouldn't have been funny.
Yeah.
It's.
I'd love to say it wasn't funny, but I'm laughing.
So. I know. many cardiovascular drugs, and ones that you may not have thought. I mean, cimetidine, although not that many people are on cimetidine anymore, but it had some issues with that, and but antihistamines, and there's even suggestion of a number of other medications, but anything that was started recently, and then also the sort of the other drugs of abuse, which would be a key feature,
sure.
You know, alcohol,
yeah.
Heroin, cocaine, nicotine,
yeah.
All those for so many different mechanisms.
And we'll need someone to write in to remind us of the Shakespeare quote about how alcohol gives you the, and I can't remember the exact thing, the enthusiasm but not the ability.
Yeah, there is a quote, and Bob Ragnow is our friend and colleague,
yes.
he knows that perfectly. In fact, we're going to be, now it gives me an opportunity to, when you bring up Shakespeare,
mm-hmm.
Our course is coming up, April 7th,
right.
And it's going to be a Shakespeare theme.
Yes, so I've heard.
So yes,
heard.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Thou hast heard correctly. So, given that one of the things you want to do with erectile dysfunction is you know, figure out if there's any potential cause. I mean, the most common cause would be some sort of atherosclerotic process as you get older.
Right.
And so, I don't know about you, but certainly, depending on the age of the person, one of the first, it should be almost an invitation to do some sort of a cardiovascular risk assessment.
Right, and certainly, the Canadian Cardiovascular Society and many others recommend that a patient complaint of erectile dysfunction that's not obviously more the psychosocial side of things, it deserves a warrant of workup of cardiovascular
right.
causes.
Yeah.
Now the question is, if you believe that, how far do you take that?
Yeah.
Does it end at some lipid screening and that kind of thing, or and blood pressure testing, or or do you go to a stress test or all of that? And I think most of us don't go that far, but it certainly I've seen that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As a recommendation, and I think that personally, I think with my patients, I don't really take it to that.
Well, I don't know what additional value that would really add.
Yeah. So if you find it, and we know the risk of a false positive with a stress test is very high. So it's a high-risk test, and it's leading us down a path that's potentially harmful to the patient.
Yeah, and it could create more harm and then more
right.
psychological strain. It could, it's never any. But again, it's just again to have it allows you to have that discussion of, now it's not that you do the CBD assessment and go, oh yeah, you know, you're X risk and here's a statin, and
yeah.
go, oh, it's going to go away. That's not,
it's
just opening the door, if you will, to say, we may need to do a cardiovascular assessment because that may be one of the causes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. But it won't fix this problem.
No, not at all. Not at all. And so, again, we are going to spend most of the time talking about the drug therapy. But there's clearly, obviously, if it's drug induced, then you have to go through the process of removing the drug, lowering the
drugs,
dose,
yeah.
and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, hopefully, that's obvious. There's a number of things that are non-drug therapy, sexual counseling, lifestyle modifications, exercise, you know,
mm-hmm.
eating healthier, and then smoking cessation, obviously. But these, again, are all under the umbrella of cardiovascular disease.
For sure. And you know, when we talk about the ones with a social element to them or a psychological element to them, those are very difficult because what you want to do is, of course, simply refer to therapy and that kind of thing. But one, that's expensive. Two, the topic is often difficult to discuss, and there's a certain amount of embarrassment. So the idea of going to someone to spend an hour going over this over the next 5
right.
weeks or 10 weeks is very unappealing.
Yeah, yeah.
So often you end up, even though we have the best intentions for that kind of an approach, many people will preferentially pick a trial
yeah.
of the PDE5.
Yeah, yeah. And it's no different than anything else. You know, if you gave the... And I think probably both you and I would take it. If you could take a pill,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't have to do all that other stuff, hard work stuff,
I know,
I'd probably take a pill.
Work for her.
Yeah, yeah, why not? But so we talked about a little bit about obviously doing things like, you know, physical activity, which is good for a variety of things.
Mm-hmm.
But there actually is a systematic review and meta-analysis of physical activity and exercise for erectile dysfunction. So we actually have studies of this, which is kind of cool.
Yes, I can't imagine being in those studies.
No.
Yeah, you want to go work out to see if it helps.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But in this, it was from the British Journal of Sports Medicine 2016. There were 7 studies, 478 participants, and they were allocated to a variety of different types of exercise, dependent on the study. But some of it was just pure aerobic activity, and other ones were specific pelvic or combined exercise interventions that they did to do this.
Mud wrestling.
That would work.
Yeah.
And it, well, it would depend who you're mud wrestling with.
I left that blank.
I know. I guess you could mud wrestle on your own, but I think that would be...
You always win and always lose every fight.
Yeah, and if that actually worked, maybe we're sending you for psychological assessment. But so if you remember, Mike, do you remember the erectile score thing we talked about?
Of course I do.
Do you? Oh, good. Oh,
I was going to say implanted, but it's embedded in my
brain. Yeah. So if you guys remember, it was a scale of sort of 0 or 1 to 25, where 25 meant no erectile dysfunction, and 1 meant basically not much is happening, mm-hmm. South of the border, if you will. And so in this systematic review meta-analysis, what they found was that physical activity, the mean difference between people who did physical activity or didn't, was a mean change in the score of around, let's round it off to, if you will,
four.
To 4.
Yeah.
So it basically had the equivalent of shifting you from either severe to moderate, or moderate to mild to moderate, or mild moderate to mild, mm-hmm. or mild to none. So I would say that would be, I don't think there, I'm not aware of a, what's clinically important, you know, the minimum clinically important difference on a scale like this. But I think that would probably
be near it. Because we know on most scales out of 10, for example, it's about a 1 change.
Exactly.
Out of 25, so you'd expect it to be around 2.5.
Yeah,
That's well above that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's encouraging that something like that, and whether it's the specific exercise or just being physically active, I don't know if anyone knows or whether anyone would really care.
Yeah, getting out of the house. Who knows?
Yeah. So, you know, at least there's some evidence that available for that sort of process.
Yeah, and that might be more palatable than going out and going for counseling for those who, for the psychological
part. Yeah.
Because, again, people don't, I think many people would choose to be active. And then we suspect probably the active part is most beneficial for those who are having the traditional age-dependent mind and cardiovascular.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so, you know, like I said, at least there's reasonable evidence for that. Now, there are sort of other things that can be done. I know when we talked about doing this podcast earlier on, I think you snickered when I brought up the concept of vacuum erection devices.
Yeah, Mike Myers would appreciate that from his first series of movies, Austin Powers.
Yeah.
That was in the original movie. It was probably 15 minutes in. And it went on like in a traditional...
They repeat, SNL.
It just kept going on and on and on. But that was what Austin Powers was using.
Oh, okay. I obviously missed that part of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there is actually some sort of research, if you will, on this in this area, if you will. And I always love sort of old quotes, although I don't know how old 1874 is, but you know. These vacuum erection devices have been around probably for a long, long period of time. But this guy was talking about, there was a great quote, and he said, when there is impotency with a diminution, and that's a word that Mike and I struggle even saying, when there's impotency with a diminution of the size of the male organ, the glass exhauster should be applied to the part.
To the part.
To the part.
Yeah. It's not clear what part. Like, is it the part in the hair?
Yes, the part. No. Oh, that's right. I left off ing. That's a parting. Oh my goodness, that makes a big difference.
It does. It leaves a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, but in a review that I could find, when you look at the how effective these devices are, you know, they call it a non-invasive method, which it would be.
I guess it's how we define invasive.
But when you look at it, and they have pictures of it, and we're not going to go in and describe how to use them and all that sort of stuff, but they when they ask about satisfaction, about 50 to 90% of men report adequate erection, and about somewhere between 25 and 75% report being satisfied with the effect of that.
Right.
Now, it's not something you probably bring up very often in practice.
No, and we did used to.
Yeah, because it was probably nothing else.
Yeah, that when the... before we got sildenafil and then its cousins. And this requires a vacuum tube. Many of you will have seen it or heard about it, even if you haven't watched Austin Powers. And then there's a device that goes at the base of the penis. It's generally like a ring or something that puts some traction on it so it holds the blood flow from leaking out. And so it's the it's kind of the two-part thing. The vacuum causes the blood to flow back into the penis, and then you have to stop it from leaking out. So mm-hmm. It's the two parts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's I don't even know if we needed to describe it in that much detail, but thank you for doing that.
It went from a PG to a mature rating for the podcast.
So those are sort of the non-drug measures, and I think why don't we leave everyone hanging?
Yeah.
And
suspended.
You've suspended. up in the air, if you will. because I think we talked a little bit about the pathophysiology and a little bit about the assessment and the non-drug measures. And I think in the next podcast, which everyone will be, they'll be on the edge of their seat,
mm-hmm.
Waiting for yep. this. We'll
raring
go,
to go.
Raring to go. They'll pay full attention.
Yeah.
And God, it's terrible, isn't it? we're like, how old are we?
14.
That's right. Which is the average age of all men.
That's right. That's
yes.
right.
So we'll talk about the drugs that are available and how effective they are and side effects and how to use them and so on in the next podcast. So please, if you like this podcast, I'm not sure why you would, but if you do like it, please go to iTunes and leave comments on it and try to make them no worse than PG.
If you're completely unaware of all radio and television.
Yeah. Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, we do have a course coming up April 7th, 8th in Vancouver of 2017. And we're just finalizing the people who are going to be attending that and or speaking at it. And so it should be a lot of fun. Check out our website. Check out the videos and all the tools for practice because they're still coming out like crazy.
Yes.
And anything else you want to sell?
Nope, that is
you all. Have no pumps or
no nothing pumps that, yeah. like nothing that I want to talk about on this podcast.
Okay, well, we'll leave it for maybe the next one.
Okay,
so thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.